This is the Graceful Atheist Podcast. Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Graceful Atheist Podcast. My name is David, and I am trying to be the Graceful Atheist. As always, if you like what you hear, please consider rating and reviewing the podcast in the Apple Podcast Store or wherever you get your podcasts. That makes the Graceful Atheist Podcast visible to more people. Please also consider letting a friend or a family member know about the podcast. I've recently had very fun stories of people introducing the podcast to others, and that is really, really exciting. I hope you are doing well in your social distancing, and hopefully the isolation is not too much. Reach out to each other and connect with people intentionally during this time of isolation. On to today's show. My guest today is Dr. Clint Haycock. Clint is the podcast host of the Mind Shift podcast that focuses on reconstruction after deconstruction, post-religion. I loved this conversation with Clint. You're going to hear both of us talk about a pastoral perspective that we are now using in the secular community. I love the tone of the Mind Shift podcast and what Clint is doing there. He has specifically focused on cults and dominion theology and the way that politics and religion have come together in the Western world today. We also discuss if there's any daylight between the concepts of deconstruction and deconversion. All in all, we have a really good time, and I hope you'll enjoy my conversation with Dr. Clint Haycock. Here's our conversation. Dr. Clint Haycock, welcome to the Graceful Atheist Podcast.
Thank you for having me, David.
Hey, I appreciate it. I've been following your work for some time now. I've listened to your podcast. You're the host of the Mind Shift podcast. I know you're doing a lot of blogging on Medium these days. Give us just the 5-minute overview of the work you're doing there.
Oh, man. We only have 5 minutes, huh?
Yeah. well, we'll have some time at the end to talk about it.
No, we'll keep it short. My podcast is really about helping people to reconstruct after they've deconstructed their religious beliefs. So they've left their faith, and that has led me into a lot of areas. I started out exclusively focusing on kind of the ex-evangelical, which is my backstory, coming out of evangelicalism. But it's led me into all sorts of other fields like cult psychology, Christian reconstructionism, dominion theology, the Christian right, Christian nationalism, because that's part of my story too. So it's part of my reconstruction to understand the way it works, I guess, and it all sort of ties together. So I'm a former Bible college teacher. I was in academics for years. So for me, I love to research things. And so as a teacher, I just have to share them. So that's really the heart of what I do. I just want to be a kind of a teacher. It's my outlet, my creative outlet. And, you know, if it helps one person, then happy days.
I hear you. No, I feel the same way about this podcast. This is as much for me as it is anyone else. Like, I have to have some expression of all this, some way to get this off my chest, because otherwise you go a little insane. So
you have to.
So you've already hinted at it, but part of what I wanted to have you on is to give you a chance as well to tell your story. You mentioned evangelicalism, but I'm not sure I know exactly the faith tradition you grew up in and what that trajectory looked like.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was raised in Seattle, Washington. I live here in the UK now. We've been here about 14 and a half years. I actually came over here to do a PhD. Yeah. And that's what brought us over here. We've luckily been able to stay on. So this is going to be our home now. You know, we're expatriates and all the rest of it.
Right.
But I grew up in Seattle, Washington, in a really, now I would say it's a fundamentalist cult. Because the church was a Church of Christ. That was the denomination.
Okay.
But they subscribed to the Bill Gothard, which at the time was called the Institute in Basic Youth Conflicts. And so everybody, not everybody, but our church strongly encouraged everybody, let's say, to attend his seminars, which we did. My family did. I remember going as a kid, 13, 14 years old, taking notes. And my parents raised us. We had a very large family. They raised us according to his teachings, which now I see. I mean, they're very toxic. I say it's a cult. It is a fundamentalist Bible cult. And so that's kind of part of the cult psychology interest of mine is I started researching the inner workings of the Gothard Empire and quickly came to see that it was a cult too. Then I realized I was raised in a cult. What does that do? You've got a, and the best advice I've heard from many, many ex-cultists and cult experts and psychiatrists is to get yourself educated, educate yourself on what, essentially what they did to you. And so that's kind of where I'm at with this journey. And so, yeah, I think I was raised in a very toxic theology.
Right.
It was the teaching that you had to be baptized in order to be saved as a Christian. So I was baptized, ended up getting baptized three times.
Got to make it work.
The first time I was about 10 or 11, I'd seen that movie, A Thief in the Night, back in the late 70s. And it terrified me that I was going to be left behind in the rapture. As a, many people have reported that experience as young children being absolutely traumatized. And so I went to the pastor and I said, I need to become a Christian. He said, let's get you baptized. And that was the first, you know, so every time I'd get baptized because I was failing in my view as a Christian. So I'd get baptized again and again, because I was so desperate to make sure that I had it right. You know, I didn't want to be left behind in the rapture.
I really find this interesting that it's the people who care about it the most, someone like yourself, you really honestly wanted to make sure that you were doing everything properly and correct. Maybe it was based out of some fear, but it was still out of desire to do the right thing.
Absolutely.
And then that tends to be the people who experience the most trauma at the back end of this.
It's true. People who they care the most, we really wanted to get it right. And besides, the theology taught that if you didn't believe the absolute correct right things, you were one of those people that stood a good chance of being left behind in the rapture.
Wow.
So in our case, I would say now what they call the good news of the gospel was not good news at all, because that opened me up into a world of absolute anxiety, stress, pressure, what they call religious scrupulosity, which is constantly monitoring every, it's an obsessive compulsive type thing, but it's instead of OCD washing your hands 1,000 times a day, you're watching every thought that you think and every action that you do and everything, you know, because God's always watching you. And anything that you do might, you know, make you a candidate for being left behind or not being a Christian. So I probably prayed the sinner's prayer, you know, thousands of times, because I just was, every night I'd lay there in bed and think, oh my God, you know, what if the rapture happens tonight? I better make sure that I'm covered. So I prayed again. And that's what led me to keep getting baptized, because I was convinced that I wasn't a Christian. And, you know, the formula hadn't worked the first time, and then the second time, and then the third time. So just keep trying. Crazy.
It sounds like, you know, you were very dedicated as well. You ultimately went on to seek an education in theology as well. Is that right?
And now I see it. I went to Bible college. I did two master's degrees. Then I did a PhD. And I realize now a lot of my motivation at the time, I didn't see it that way then, but I was, it was to genuinely help people avoid the same kind of pitfalls that I had fallen into growing up in church. So I was determined I was going to go to Bible college. Then I was going to go to seminary. I was going to study the Greek, study the Hebrew, really take a deep dive into the Bible and theology so that I could explain it to other people in a clear and helpful way, which that led me into becoming a pastor and then a Bible college teacher, because, I mean, I am a teacher at heart. I can't help it. That's how I'm wired. It's true. And so for me, it was a natural fit. You know, what better thing to teach than the Bible and to preach it? And if I could help somebody by my explanation of a particular passage or Old Testament, New Testament book or whatever, then I was doing my job as a pastor, as a spiritual leader. And I see that now. That's, that was my drive to be a pastor, which ironically is a lot of the same drive that I have now. I'm, I'm still kind of pastoring people. Weirdly, there's a lot of ex-pastors out there that say the same thing, that we still feel like we're doing pastoral work. It's just we're not preaching the Bible or leading people to Christ anymore.
You know, I often say that, you know, when we lose our faith, that doesn't mean that we don't need connection and belonging and in some cases, pastoral care, right?
Yeah, a community.
It's a human need that we have. And that's absolutely the best of religion, is how it can bring people together. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we're talking about the darker side of things, but I'm very fascinated, and we'll maybe talk about this a little bit later, of how we recreate the best parts of that in a more secularized environment.
Absolutely. It's true that one thing the church, on some levels, they do well, and that is offer community.
Yeah.
You know, someone said once that it's a ready-made community. You just have to slot into it. It's all there. It's all the pieces are there. Once you do the right thing, say the right things, whatever the denomination or tradition has you do, get baptized or get confirmation or you know, bar mitzvah or whatever your rite of passage is,
yeah,
then you're accepted. And it's a wonderful thing to be part of a community of people that believe the same things you do, more or less, and you're accepted, and you do have community. I mean, I had and still do have some wonderful friendships and relationships from the church when I was a pastor and before I was a pastor, you know, so I don't take that lightly. But like you said, we as humans, we need it.
Yeah, exactly.
The church is offering it. So why not just slot in and become a Christian?
Right. you know, just briefly, my story, you know, I was a cultural Christian. My family were believers, but it was very passive. And when my mom got clean and sober and she had a kind of an epiphany experience, then we got very, very religious, very fundamentalist. And, you know, I sometimes point out the difference between the people who were raised in it. Like if you were raised in it as a child, the trauma inducing nature of the fear of the rapture, or the fear of going to hell, you know, as a child, how do you grapple with that? Versus even just being a teenager when I converted, you know, I had some sense of who I was as a person, and some ability to, this is all hindsight, you know, but some ability to separate that and to recognize it was a little less trauma experience for me personally. I know you've talked to lots of people on your podcast. Have you noticed that at all? Have you talked to people that converted at different ages?
Yes. In fact, I have a bunch of recordings. I haven't had time to edit them down into a complete episode, but I was going to do a study on the differences between first and second generation religious people, not just limited to Christianity, but cults as well, whatever religions that they were a part of. As you say, there is a massive difference between what they call first and second generation religions or cults. And the biggest difference that I've found is that for people who come into it later in life, they develop a process. It's where Robert Lifton, he's a psychologist that did a lot of seminal work on cults and brainwashing. He describes it as this process called doubling, where you almost create a second self and you to fit into the group. And you have your authentic self, which is the real you. And then you have the religious self that you almost have to create. They live side by side in a way to fit into the group and, you know, be accepted, and the wonderful community we were talking about.
Yeah.
The difference between first generation or the people who second generation who were raised in it, they only ever had the religious identity. That's all we had.
Right.
So I never experienced doubling because I never had any other personality other than the religious one. So that's a whole different journey out, because it was my whole worldview. I believed it. My parents said it was true. The pastor said it was true. These are authority figures that I trusted. I believed them. Why would they lie to me? They weren't lying to me. They believed it.
Right. They were convinced.
Yeah. They were committed. I'm not saying they misled us intentionally, but the damage was done nonetheless. And so disentangling from that is in some ways a lot more difficult than someone who, well, it's a different journey, I should say. It's not about ease of transition. Some people have a much harder time on either path.
Yeah. You know, the thing that I'm relating to the most here, so for me, I recognize that doubling in my life. I was convinced that the church didn't understand grace. As you can see, I've carried over some of those ideas into the secular world. But yeah,
ironically.
When I became a Christian, I thought, you know, I read particularly the Gospels, and I thought, man, this concept of grace is so amazing. And it's just that the people who have been in church for so long, they've forgotten. They just don't remember how powerful this is. And I thought, And I relate to the teacher thing. If I just teach them, if I just have the right words, you know, they're going to get it. Things are going to be different. And one of the things that I recognized was that people were not their authentic selves. There was the need to present an image because if they were honest, they would be judged.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't possible to be your authentic self. And my theory was that that's where we needed to get to, was the ability to have enough acceptance and grace that we could be our authentic selves with each other. Turned out that wasn't going to work, but
it was a horrible failure.
That was the goal.
I can resonate with that because that was kind of my philosophy of ministry as a pastor. And then later when I taught for about 8 years in a Bible college over here in the UK. And that was really my driving focus for my students because they were all heading into ministry. And so I was always teaching them that they need to be raising up men and women to be the person God made them to be. That was my kind of thing,
right?
You know, and to be your authentic self. And I didn't see the ironies, of course, at the time, but I was on that same trajectory of trying to encourage people to be real, to be themselves, blah, blah, blah. But as you say, most churches are not safe.
Yeah.
They're not a safe space. So you can't afford to be real because, as you say, you could be judged, you could be ostracized. That's the dark side of that lovely community we were talking about, where one minute you're in it and then you enter into the cult psychology, which again, Lifton calls the dispensing of existence. You don't have the right to exist because you've questioned things or you've bucked the status quo. So you're gone. You're right. Out of here.
Right.
And that's how it works. You're shunned.
Yeah. And that shunning, that's the loss of that community. That is devastating to people.
Absolutely.
I think the reason that people stay in for so long, even when they begin to have doubts, is the idea of walking away from that community is a huge mountain to climb.
Mm-hmm. Well, and part of that is to the sunk cost fallacy. I think that's operative as well as the cognitive dissonance. You get to that point where you've put so much into the thing that you can't envision any other option other than to stay in.
Right.
You know, maybe right. It's going to get better. Yeah, it has its downsides, and there's people that gossip and backstab, and some horrible things happen, and I got burned here and there. But look at the money I've spent. Look at the time I've invested.
Yeah.
And that's part of the deconstruction and reconstruction piece for people that spent, you know, I mean, look at me. I spent decades spending money and spending incredible amounts of time going to schools and studying and teaching and writing and doing all this stuff. For what? You know, for what?
Yeah.
The only thing I have to show for it, someone said to me the other day that the one good thing about all the background that you've got is that it allows you to speak knowledgeably about theology and Bible. And you can, you know, talk about this stuff from an informed perspective. I'm not an outsider looking in. We were part of the system. So we know what we're talking about.
Yeah. If only that respect were given, I think. We're often seen as the, you know, wolves in sheep's clothing. And so anything we say is just dismissed.
Well, and we're in the midst of this coronavirus, but we're seen as like a contagious virus. I think people that leave the church, especially that were high profile leaders.
Yeah.
And I talked to Tim Sledge. He wrote the book Goodbye Jesus and all that, but he was a mega church pastor out of Houston, Texas. I mean, guys that were high profile like him, they have vilified him left, right, and center because they kind of have to. You know, when a high profile person like Josh Harris, the guy who wrote I Kiss Dating Goodbye, he repudiated it all. And man, they ripped him to shreds. You know, there's been several high profile people that have left recently, and that you read the articles and the Facebook posts, man, they have to say they were never a Christian in the first place. And you know, all that.
It's definitely terrible. I wonder what you would say to those people. Like, what does any deconversion or any deconstruction, but those high profile ones in particular, say to the people who are still in the bubble?
That's a hard one because it's part of that cult psychology. I don't think evangelicalism as a whole is a cult. It's too broad. It's too diverse. It's, you know, not a monolith, but there are many, many, many cultic tactics and psychological mind control things that go on within churches. So you have to realize that you're talking to people who, to some extent, are in a bubble. something that Rick Ross says. He's a cult expert. He said that when you're in the bubble and you're receiving their downloads, it's very, very hard to think critically.
Yeah.
Only when you physically remove yourself and psychologically remove yourself and unplug, as it were, from the system and stop receiving their downloads, that's when you start to think critically. But if you're in the midst of the Lifton calls milieu control, you're in the milieu that's being controlled by the people at the top, you know, you're literally under their control. And we never saw it that way, I'm sure, you know, when we were part of the system.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I've heard what you've just said there in different terms before. I did an interview with Cassidy, who's the blogger behind Roll to Disbelieve.
Hmm.
And part of her deconversion story was prayer group that they were trying to start, and they only had three people, and they were in some closet in a college, and, you know, didn't have the context.
Mm-hmm.
She realized in that moment that she was trying to create the feeling of God's presence and that it wasn't there. That snapped for her. That was the thing that broke her out of the bubble, where she could see, oh, it depends on the context. Or the, or in your words, the milieu, you know, that it's an environment that you're in, whether this makes sense or not.
Absolutely. And the next, these are all what Robert Lifton, he has these eight markers of cults. Milieu control is the first one. The second one is mystical manipulation, which is exactly what you were just describing.
Yeah.
When you go into, let's say, a church, you don't realize that you're entering into a milieu or a context that is being, you're being manipulated. And it's creating an environment with the music and the lighting and the ambiance and the preacher, and the whole context is manipulated in such a way to make you feel, and you are literally on a genuine emotional journey. You really are. There's no question about it.
Right.
The music is unbelievable, especially in some of these churches where they've got fantastic worship bands. I mean,
yeah, like Hillsong or.
Yeah, I mean, it's a full-on professional concert. You're going to see a band that's every bit as good as any professional band that's going to be on stage in a major stadium.
Yeah.
Musically, professionally. And they are at the top of their game, and they can play the crowd and move you from fast, upbeat tempo songs to slower, more introspective songs. The lighting comes down.
Yeah.
Man, it is genuinely moving. There's no question about it. But what they do is they ascribe that to God, as you said. And then here comes the sermon, and here's 30, 40 minutes of rah-rah Jesus indoctrination, and a few more songs, and you pumped up. And it's a religious addiction, because you have to go back the next week to experience the same high. You know, you're always chasing that experience. And so you've got to come back to church and get it again.
Yeah, definitely. And I think music is such a human connection for us.
It is.
When we participate in a shared musical experience, that is a really bonding thing. Mm. Right now, as we're recording, you know, we know that COVID-19's an epidemic, a pandemic. And the things that we see that go viral are people out on their verandas, you know, singing with each other, right?
Like, yeah, the Italians singing across to each other.
Exactly. It's like, that is just something that we need to do.
It really is.
In a way, the religion has kind of hijacked that and taken it over.
Yeah, they've made use of it. And absolutely, I mean, I played in worship bands for years. I'm a drummer, and I felt that emotional. You get that connection with the audience. If you hit the pocket, kind of like a thing where you know how it is. If you're playing live, whether you're playing rock and roll or blues or worship music, if you're hitting the right notes with the crowd, as it were, they get into it, and there's this symbiotic relationship between you and the audience. And I mean, I can remember many times where the worship leader would turn and, you know, let's go around because there's something happening here.
Right.
You can see the audience really getting moved emotionally. And so let's play another bar. Let's play another verse. Let's, you know, keep the chorus going. And we would just flow with it. And we would say at the time, well, we were flowing with the Spirit, man. That's what it was all about. We were just, you know, the Holy Spirit took over, and we were just riding the wave. And I play in a rock and blues band. I felt the same thing playing AC/DC songs. You know?
Yeah, exactly.
We used to end our set with the song from Rocky Horror Picture Show, The Time Warp, you know, and that always went down just as big as any worship song in a church, you know.
Yeah.
There's nothing like seeing like 400 bikers doing the Time Warp dance, you know, at a biker rally.
Yeah, totally.
And it's amazing. And it has nothing to do with the Holy Spirit.
Right. It literally is resonance. right? It's that like people, their emotions are feeding on one another, and there's a resonant quality to that, and it's feeding back to the musicians, and you know, just it's a positive feedback loop.
It is, and it's a wonderful thing. You know, if you're a musician, you know how it feels. There's a high from playing on stage live, and there's a high from being in a crowd that's where the band is really killing it. We've all been to concerts, secular concerts, I'm sure, where we've seen bands that just blew our minds.
Yeah.
You know, and it was an emotional experience to see that, especially when you have a band that you've really loved for years and then they come to town and you've never seen them live before. And like, oh man, I got tickets to see these guys. And they just exceeded your expectations, you know, and you're on a high.
Yeah.
And it absolutely is. So you can replicate that in a church. Absolutely.
I realize that we've kind of gone way out of order here. And I do want to return to some of these subjects, but I want just real quick, I don't want to lose track of what for you personally, Clint, were the cracks that started to form the doubts that ultimately led to deconstruction for you?
Well, I see it now. I didn't see it at the time. I see it now as the cognitive dissonance was surfacing, and maybe that was my authentic self somehow in there, even though I was mostly the religious self, still was the real me going, hey, this doesn't add up. And I can remember even in Bible college, I felt like a hypocrite because I was preparing for ministry and I had doubts, but I didn't want to stand up in front of an audience or a classroom of students teaching them something that I felt that I didn't believe in or wasn't working for me personally. And I really wrestled with that problem for years. I remember going to mentors at Bible college and seminary, talking to pastors and saying, what's going on here? Because I'm not sure I'm buying this product that I'm supposed to be selling. And I can see that now it wasn't working.
Right.
But I could never admit that to myself. I just thought it's something wrong with me. It's always the problem, isn't it? Where doubt gets thrown back onto the doubter.
Right.
Something's wrong with you. It's never God's fault, obviously.
Yeah.
And it's not the fault of the Bible. You're just not interpreting it correctly or whatever. Your theology isn't right, or maybe you've got hidden sin in your life, or there's a million and one reasons why it might not be working, but it's never God's fault. Going back to what you said, I really wanted to get it right. I do not want to feel like I'm a hypocrite standing in front of a crowd telling them to believe something and that it should change your life when I myself wasn't doing half the stuff I was telling my congregation to do.
Yeah. And I've had people on who tell a story where they wanted God to change them. They were asking, you know, change me. I recognize this isn't the best I can do. Help me. And then it was the recognition of that not happening, that there was no assistance. There was no helper available to assist them in changing.
Yeah. Going back to my experience, as I was talking about as a kid, why I kept getting baptized, because I was begging and pleading God to help me, as you just described, and no help was forthcoming. For example, I was in the purity culture. Mm-hmm. That was another part of the toxicity of the doctrine. And I've realized this now, a lot of kids raised in the purity culture, they have to suppress their sexuality. So they turn to pornography as an outlet. So I became addicted to pornography. And of course, I knew that was wrong. I felt horrible about that. At least I knew I wasn't having actual physical sex, which was slightly better. But then I was, you know, turning to porn.
Yeah.
And that was a sin. So, I mean, I begged and pleaded, and I've heard many stories of kids like me who did the same thing, asking God to take it away, to help me, nothing. And why? Isn't he interested in helping you to become that perfect Christian or perfect kid who doesn't sin? Why? Why not give me some help? Throw me a bone, you know?
Yeah.
Nothing.
I get you. I think that on all levels, the repression of normal human sexual desire is destructive, right? It doesn't matter, you know, how you wind up dealing with that, whether that's porn. I think the church would be so much better if they just said, yeah, masturbation is normal. You should do that if you want to. There'd be a whole lot fewer problems, you know? Yeah. Like, but they can't, there's no way they could ever.
Can't say.
They can't say that.
I mean, I remember going to pastors' conferences. We used to go to the Oregon coast and go to these weekend long pastors' conferences. And by about the end of the Sunday evening session, it was 40 or 50 pastors in a room and they were broken down and most of them were confessing all kinds of sins. And the biggest one is pornography and, you know, masturbation.
Yeah.
Pastors who could never, ever admit that to their own wives, for one thing, or certainly not to their congregation. Can you imagine that? Yeah. If a high profile pastor went up and said, look, people, I've been watching porn for years. I'm addicted to it. I got a real problem. Man, they'd be out in most cases.
Yeah.
So fast.
I was fascinated by it when I was in the middle of, you know, I went to a Bible college. Purity culture was very much a part of that. I was just honest with myself. I was, you know, like, I'm going to masturbate. And, you know, and I would definitely be, you know, I'd feel guilty and I would confess and that whole cycle. But something in the back of my mind was like, this is normal. The statistics on men in particular, yeah. but women too, just well over 50% of the whole population. This is just a normal thing. Mm. Some tiny part of me recognized that it was just ludicrous to beat myself up over something that was just a normal human thing.
Absolutely. And you could analyze it from what we talked about, that perspective of doubling. Your religious self is at war with your authentic self. Your authentic self saying, hey, this is normal. Religious self's going, no, it's a sin. It's wrong. You need to confess and repent and get right and stop doing it. Yeah. Throw away the magazine. Stop getting online. Stop looking at porn. You know, you've got to get it right and stop and suppress that sexuality until you get married and you're supposed to be a virgin on your wedding day, blah, right. blah, blah. That's the purity culture.
I know that lots of the listeners will be very familiar with that. I know how destructive that is.
It is. I just wrote an article on Medium about that because we did a bunch of talking on it years ago with some people in a Facebook group. And I kind of stumbled across a bunch of these comments that I had archived. And I was reading through them about, you know, I asked the question in this group, what damage has the purity culture done to you, this ex-evangelical group? And I got a shocking array of responses. So I just started cutting and pasting them anonymously and putting them in a Word document. And it was like 10 or 12 pages long. I thought, my God, I got to do something with this. So I put this article together talking about specific instances of damage that the purity culture does to us sexually, psychologically, et cetera, et cetera. It's quite shocking when you actually stand back and look at what it does.
Yeah.
And that's all part of the church's toxicity, you know?
Yeah.
Wow.
To, again, circle back just a little bit to the personal. So you recognized that there was a disparity between what you were teaching and what you were acting out or what you believed. What did that result in? Did you walk away from that teaching gig? How did that look?
I got made redundant, as they say in this country. I got laid off from the teaching gig. Through no fault of my own, it was a case of the college that I was teaching for. I'd been there about 7 or 8 years. They ran into huge debt. And so they laid a bunch of us off. Most of us lost our jobs without any warning. We just were gone, just like that. I got home from my last day of teaching just before Christmas, ironically, to see a letter on my table saying, your services are no longer required. Oh, man.
Merry Christmas.
Oh, and by the way, they said, you know, the college is in financial trouble. You wouldn't mind donating your final month's pay.
Oh, my goodness.
Help us get through this shortfall after we've just laid you off. I could not believe that. They actually said that. Yeah, I'll give you my last month's salary when I don't have a job to go to now. Thank you very much. You know?
Wow.
But I see now they did me a favor, but that was quite shocking. I mean, I cannot imagine a company doing something like that to an employee.
Yeah.
You lay somebody off and then turn around and say, oh, you wouldn't mind donating your final month's pay to help us out here. But it was a Bible college.
That is incredibly tone deaf. Very tone deaf.
Oh. And I wrote an email to the head of the college saying, I cannot believe, you know, that you've done this and you're asking me to give you my last month's pay. And I said, I've been here 8 years, and that's how I found out I don't even have a job anymore. And his response was equally tone deaf. He said, well, actually, you shouldn't be upset. You were never actually an employee. You were a contract lecturer. Uh-huh. What's the problem? We just didn't renew your contract. What are you so upset about?
Oh, man. Yeah. So, yeah, that's insane.
Tone deafness. Unbelievable. What do you see? You were never an employee here. What are you so pissed off about? You're just, you know, you're not coming back, and that's it, period. What's the problem?
Wow.
I don't know. 8 years of teaching for nothing.
That's terrible.
Yeah, it really is.
So what made you decide to start to go to the dark side a bit, to start expressing your deconstruction out loud, to blog about it, to whatever your first steps were? What happened there?
It was the podcast that I started. I've changed the name. Now it's Mindshift Podcast, but originally 4 years ago, it was called the Preacher's Forum podcast.
Okay.
And that was my last gasp of trying to reform the church. So I'd gone through this cycle of reading progressive Christians, jettisoning a lot of my fundamentalist evangelical conservative dogmas. And that was the journey I was on. I was like, okay, I'm going to help the church get relevant. Kind of like you said, your path of let's help the church discover grace. That's what I was teaching my students. I was having them question things and exposing them to a lot of progressive ideas and pushing the limits a little bit. But then I see now that was my journey, the way out, because as I was jettisoning the pieces, eventually there was nothing left. But that journey was to really one last push to kind of reform the church. What I realized is they didn't want to hear it. Nobody wanted to hear it. They were not listening. You know, I was just an angry, ranting ex-pastor who was still a Christian, though. And then as I went down the line further and further and further, I realized I've got nothing left. So that's when I realized that the idea of the Preacher's Forum, it totally doesn't fit. The name doesn't fit. The branding doesn't work. It's nothing about what I am standing for. So I changed it to the Mindshift podcast. And that's where I guess someone said to me, you've deconstructed in front of an audience,
right?
And over the 3 or 4 years, that's kind of what I've done. And the name, the Preacher's Forum, reflects my own journey out. That was the last straw. But the last thing for me was actually the 2016 evangelical Trump support.
Yeah.
When I saw that, I said to myself, I'm no longer ever going to call myself a Christian. I don't want to have anything to do with it. That was the final straw. I was done. I said, I don't want to have anything to do with that movement, evangelicalism.
Yeah.
Maybe that's an overreaction, but to me, events have borne out the fact that it's a completely bankrupt system in many ways. I mean, there's some great Christians out there, no doubt. I'm not throwing all the baby out with the bathwater, but for a lot of people, that was their last straw.
Like, my wife is still very much a believer, and she was just crushed by that and continues to be crushed every time we see an evangelical who, and it's not just a political thing here, but blindly supports Trump. So I know that that has affected numbers of people, huge numbers of people that led them to deconstruction. I want to segue here just briefly and ask you, your motto of the podcast is reconstruction after deconstruction. Can I get your definitions of both of those words? What do those mean to you?
I would say that the deconstruction part is when people question their deeply held beliefs, you know, on a very worldview level type of thing. And it's very traumatic. It's very scary. There's a lot of emotions associated with it because it was something that we believed wholeheartedly, like we've been talking about. If we were in the system, especially people that were in any form of leadership in the church or in a religion, it's really hard to question those things.
Yeah.
What it's a case, I think, a lot of people's story is when that cognitive dissonance, the dissonance becomes too much.
Yeah.
Like you said, the cracks, you cannot paper over the cracks anymore. Eventually the walls start falling down. 50 layers of wallpaper won't won't hide the structural flaws in the building.
Exactly. <You know? laughs> Yeah. So I've got an article that's similar to one that you've written, but that talks about this process. And I begin with unexpected events happen. Something makes you think about this, but then as you go along, they stack up and you hit some critical mass point at which, just what you've described, you can no longer pretend anymore that there isn't a problem.
You can't do it. And going back to the cult psychology, that's what a lot of people, there's a lot of ways to quell the cognitive dissonance. Christianese is a good one. And that's what we used in the church, you know, sort of pithy statements, platitudes, Bible verses that cover, and those are sort of that wallpaper covering the cognitive dissonance. We don't understand why things happen. You're seeing it right now with the coronavirus, the COVID-19. Look at the various Christian responses to it. They are scrambling to try to come up with some answers because there isn't any. Why is this happening? Because they are holding to the presupposition that God is all powerful, God's in control of everything. What the hell is going on here?
Yeah, yes.
I mean, seriously, is it a judgment? Is it a satanic attack? Is it, they've got to come up with something. And so you see all sorts of people that are walking around quoting Psalm 91, faith conquers fear, and I don't have to wear a mask. I can disregard it all. because God's going to protect me. That's straight loaded language, as Lifton calls it. It's thought terminating cliches, and that's what it is. And that's what I did for a long time. As you say, the weight finally, though, got too much. Yeah. And I can see now that the progressive Christians was part of that journey. Guys like Brian McLaren and Rob Bell and Donald Miller, because they helped me to see that I was part of a formulaic religion. And once I saw that, I thought, my God, I have been practicing a religion that's been reduced to a formula. What I need to do is discover the authentic Christianity. And then I wasn't able to do it.
Okay.
It's sort of like Easy Rider, you know, the two guys that go off on their Harleys to try to rediscover the real America, and they can't find it. It's not there.
Right.
It ain't there. And in the end, they end up getting killed, you know? So it doesn't end well.
This is really where I wanted to go. This is a really interesting thing that you've just said, trying to find the authentic Christianity and then not being able to find it. And I want to preface this by saying that I try to avoid falling into the angry atheist, the new atheist perspective. There's part of me that gets pulled that direction to just say, you know, just the story you just told, you know, you'll have someone standing in front of a tornado strewn street and their house is destroyed, but they survived, and they'll be like, well, thank God.
Their Bible's untouched, sitting on the nightstand.
100 people are dead and this massive destruction, but, you know, I made it out. So that's great. That's right. It's the ability to miss all of that.
Yeah.
But my point is, I want to be this idea of secular grace, to be graceful, to recognize where people are at, which includes various levels of progressive Christianity, various levels of deconstruction, what have you. And I'm confessing my faults to you that at times I can be critical, and I try to overcome that. But but what you just said is just really fascinating to me, in that we have lots of progressive friends who are trying to live that out, who are trying to find that authentic Christianity. What would you say to them?
That's a good question, because I had a conversation recently with Dan Koch, who's a progressive Christian, and we went around and around. We had a really good, respectful dialogue. It wasn't an argument. And I come from the same perspective as you. I'm not trying to talk anybody out of anything. Sure. Or into anything. I will have a respectful dialogue as long as anyone wants to talk with me. Absolutely. And the question that I posed at the end of it all, I mean, there's no question but that the church, and I'm generalizing, but, you know, including Catholicism, and
sure,
there's so many abuses. There's no question about it. There's sexual abuse, there's pedophilia, there's spiritual abuse, and religious trauma syndrome. And you can have a laundry list: hell-induced PTSD, anxiety, depression, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's caused by the church. So I said to Dan, whose fault is it? Because is it God's fault that all this is so messed up? Or is it the fault of humanity, who took something that was pure and then corrupted it? Mm. What we need to do is get back to that pure faith, you know? And I think that was my journey, as you said, for a long time. I was hoping to find that sort of Acts chapter 2 church, you know, community. And that was what I taught my students to aim for. And now I realize that I think I never found it, you know? But for the progressive Christian, I have a hard time supporting some of that. I get where they're coming from, I think, because I was on that same path.
Sure, sure.
But I couldn't reconcile it with all the damage that was being done by the church. And I thought, you know, after 4 or 5 years of trying to get people to see my point of view, and nobody wanted to listen, I thought, well, I'm done. I'm not beating my head against the wall here.
Yeah, yeah. I guess the reason I bring this up is there's definitely part of me that still just wants to say, let it go.
Yeah.
You're hurting yourself by trying to make this work.
Mm-hmm.
And my argument is this, that if you do the Thomas Jefferson thing, you rip all the miracles out of the Bible. If you take one more step and take all the archaic morality out of the Bible, you're left with a pamphlet that says you ought to be good to people. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's about it. And that the baggage that comes with traditional Christianity actually holds people back.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I'm recognizing that maybe that's being too critical and people meet people where they're at and what their needs are. But there's part of me that definitely just wants to say, you can be free from this, and we can recognize what we need from one another as human beings. We still need to have community. We still need to have a sense of awe. We need to have a sense of of beauty, of something even bigger than ourselves, if you will, but that doesn't need to be supernatural.
Mm-hmm.
But nature and humanity provides all of those needs. And this is ultimately my argument, that even in the church, it was still just humanity that was providing those needs, right? It was musicians like yourself. It's the pastors doing, you know, they're at the bedside of somebody who's dying, feeding the hungry. Actually,
sure,
the action on the ground was the miracle. It's the people that are the magic.
Well, and as you say, look at the examples from church history, what you just were articulating, the difference between, you go back 100 years, the difference between classic liberal theology and the fundamentalist back around the end of the 19th century up to about 1940s, 50s, into the 60s even, where the liberals tried to accommodate their Christian faith with modern science. And they were saying kind of the same thing. Let's take biblical criticism as an example. You know, all this stuff that was questioning the authorship of the Bible and the Pentateuch, did Moses write it, and on and on and on. And they said, yeah, we believe what these scholars are finding in the text. We don't think it's every word was written by an inspired prophet and all the rest of it. Whereas the fundamentalists, they doubled down. And so we see those two streams where the liberals, a lot of them did end up as atheists because they finally said there's nothing left.
There's nowhere to go. Yeah.
Yeah.
That ultimately leads me to the next question. I talked to you before we got on mic about, is there daylight between the concept of deconstruction and deconversion? Mm. And usually when I use the term deconversion, I mean the letting go of faith of any kind, of recognizing that it's basically the natural world is what we have. And I guess the point for me was the last two things that I held on to the bitter end were the concept of a soul and the resurrection. And when I realized that I had no reason, no evidences, no reliable reasons to hold on to those any longer, that was the thing that I was just done. At that point, I wasn't interested in going and exploring other religious traditions. I wasn't looking at other sects of Christianity. I was just done. And I'm curious if you think that most people deconstruct to some point and then fall off a cliff, or is it possible to just keep deconstruction going indefinitely?
Sure. Well, looking at my example, you know, when I was talking about reading progressive Christians, I was deconstructing. I was questioning a lot of things. My mind was being blown. Like I said, when I discovered that Christianity that I was following was a formulaic religion, that blew my mind, but I was still very much a Christian. However, I jettisoned a tremendous amount of stuff from my past that I thought was absolutely indispensable. And then I realized was not only not indispensable, it was actually quite damaging and harmful to my own mental health and the way I lived my life and treated other people. But I was still very much a Christian. Yeah. So like you said, that's deconstruction. You're questioning. A lot of people do that and then never leave Christianity or whatever religion they're a part of. They question things, they jettison things, they don't believe certain things anymore. They might believe different things now, but they still consider themselves a Mormon, Jehovah's Witness, whatever. Sure. But like you say, that if you're going to define deconversion as the point where you say, I am no longer a Christian or a whatever, I walk away, I'd repudiate the whole thing. Mm. I'm not trying to salvage anything. I'm not trying to save anything. I am done. That must be the difference between deconstructing and deconverting. And maybe one doesn't always inevitably lead to the other, but it certainly can for a lot of people it has.
Sure. I definitely recognize, very similar to you, of you can say liberalizing, but I am also fascinated by the mere Christianity Christians who say, well, you know, these little minor doctrinal differences, they don't really matter. You know, it's really about, it's about the cross, it's about the resurrection. But I feel like I did that. I went to that edge where I was just hanging on to the resurrection has to be real the way it's stated, or I agree with Paul that this is all worthless. we're the most to be pitied, right? And it was when I fell off that cliff where I realized, that it wasn't true. I thought it was, and I was mistaken.
Well, and one thing we haven't really touched on, I kind of mentioned it with the liberals, but the question of what Bible are you talking about? Because that's a whole huge problem that I'm sure we could get into somewhere else. But, you know, that's one thing that I was struggling with increasingly, because the more I studied the Bible as a scholar, and I did my PhD on the book of Ezekiel. And one of the things I discovered about Ezekiel was, of course, there was the big debates as to the scholarship of Ezekiel. Did Ezekiel write the book? Blah, blah, blah. And I realized, no, it was compiled from a bunch of different sources, and that's the consensus of most scholarship, certainly in the Old Testament. And there's a lot of questions about the New Testament. And that led me to think, okay, this fundamentalist conservative view of the Bible, and therefore the interpretations that are drawn from that view of the Bible, cannot possibly be consistent, because the text doesn't support that. It really doesn't. Right. Scholarship has shown definitively that is not the case. And there's a lot of questions around the Gospels and the historicity of Jesus. You know, so if you can argue about who Jesus was and what Jesus taught, and we need to recover the true Jesus, which Jesus?
Right.
And which gospel?
Yes. Yeah.
You know, there's significant discrepancies. One of the things I used to have my students do when I was teaching New Testament, I would make them study three different passages from Matthew, Mark, and Luke that were parallel passages giving the same account of an event. And I would have them list all the similarities and all the differences between the three. And there was a huge list of discrepancies. And right. that blew their minds, because they were like, no, they all have to agree. They cannot possibly disagree. And I'd say, well, what do you do with that?
Right.
Which account is right? Which account is historically, and it's all historically true, but it cannot be, because they contradict each other in key details. Yeah. So who's right? Which one's correct? You know, there's cognitive dissonance for you.
Yeah.
So after that class session, a lady came up to me and said, are you a Christian? And I said, why would you say that? I'm teaching at a Bible college. She said, because you're having us question the Bible, and that Christians don't do that.
Yeah.
So that was her go-to answer.
You know, I often say that my Bible college teachers did their job too well.
Mm-hmm.
In that, you know, my college experience, at least in the classroom, was really good. It was critical thinking. It was a bit of textual criticism. It was, sure. they didn't take it too far, but a little bit. You know, they would recognize that, yeah, the Gospels are anonymous. They are hagiographies. You know, they would acknowledge that much, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, hand wave about, well, it's still authoritative in some way or another. But my point is that they, you know, they conveyed the idea of good exegesis, of good study, of good hermeneutics, interpretation, of good recognizing, you know, what it meant to the author, original author and the original hearers. And when you start to go down that road and you recognize, as you said, many books of the Bible are compilations that have multiple authors, that have multiple time periods represented, that have multiple theological perspectives that are trying to be asserted, you know, that when you get to that point where you're just kind of honest with the text itself, that that's what it is, it's very, very hard to then maintain that this is some kind of supernatural developed product, as it were.
Yeah, this inspired product that's inerrant, mistake-free, error-free.
Right.
But look at, for example, if you just take a straight reading of the text, you end up with a God in the Old Testament who commands genocide.
Yeah.
And he commands laws in the book of Leviticus and Exodus and other places that are absolutely horrific. We would repudiate them today as human rights violations on all kinds of levels. And so you go, wait a minute, if that's the same God of the New Testament that you're worshiping in a church every Sunday, what about that?
Yeah.
How can you worship a God who commanded genocide on multiple occasions? And that's the same God you're singing about and worshiping on a Sunday. What? This doesn't make any sense. And that's just a straight reading of the text. Now, of course, there's a million answers. I studied it myself, theodicy, the problem of evil. You know, there's a million reasons why God's let off the hook, and it's not his fault, and blah, blah, blah. But that's bullshit.
Yeah.
He commanded his people to kill men, women, children, animals, slaughter them without mercy.
Yeah.
We would condemn that as a war crime today. We sent the Nazis to the gallows for that, for killing millions of Jews in World War II. And that's just the same scale, maybe not as industrialized, of course, but same principle.
Yeah, for sure. You know, about 2 years before my deconversion, I had read through the Bible, and my wife, you know, she'd say, "You're angry. Why are you angry?" And at the time, at the time, I had no idea why. Now, with hindsight, I recognize I was reading it straight through, you know, all including the boring parts, including Ezekiel, including the prophets, including. And it's horrifying what it actually says.
Yeah, it is.
You know, so if you, I always recommend, you know, if you're a believer, read the Bible, right? Read it.
That'll make an atheist out of you.
Yeah. The only thing I request is that you see it for what it actually says, rather as what most people do is they interpret it in light of, for my case, I previously had interpreted all in light of grace, right? Well, God was judgmental because he was bringing the Hebrew people together, and needed to keep purity and what have you. But when I started to let go of that, I took the rose-colored glasses off and just read the text. What does it say?
Mm-hmm.
That was devastating. It was absolutely devastating.
It is. And that was part of the shocking journey going through Ezekiel, reading the book from a theological point of view. Then I started reading it as a narrative text. That's what blew my mind. It's actually a story about right. this prophet who's in Babylon with these exiles, and he's trying to get through to them and all this. And at one point, God comes to Ezekiel and says, according to the text, tomorrow, your wife's going to die. I'm going to kill your wife, and you will not be allowed to mourn for her as some sort of object lesson to your fellow exiles here in Babylon. And God killed Ezekiel's wife, and he wasn't allowed to shed a single tear. And that's horrifying.
Yeah.
If that's true, narrative of historical whatever. But I mean, that's what the text says, man.
Right.
What the hell? And Ezekiel, he was the good guy. That's the
thing. Exactly.
He was a prophet.
Yeah.
He was obeying. He was doing everything all the ridiculous things God was telling him to do. Yeah. And God kills his wife. What kind of a monster is that? The same guy who destroys Job's life or allows Satan to over a cosmic bet with the devil that Job never finds out about. I mean, if that's the God of the Bible, I don't want to have anything to do with that God. That's what did it for me.
Yeah.
No way.
I can definitely relate.
Yeah.
I feel like we've done a pretty good job of bashing the Bible and stuff. So I want to turn the corner just a little bit and talk about, first of all, do you consider yourself an atheist? Do you pick a term that you identify with? Is there an agnostic?
I'd say I'm more of an agnostic, I think. Okay. I'm definitely deconverted.
Okay.
No, I'm not a Christian. There's no question about that. I don't call myself a Christian. But I'm not sure. I have a lot of problems with that God. Like I've been saying, it seems pretty clear. I get passionate when I start talking about because I have a lot of questions. If that God exists, the one of the Bible, there's some serious problems.
Right.
I want some answers to those questions, and I'm not getting them. I ain't getting them, And so I'm not sure if there is a God out there. If he does exist, wow, we've got some serious issues to deal with. So I could see the appeal of saying, it's probably better off saying it's all made up and there's no God.
Right.
Become an atheist and sack the whole thing off.
So then I want to use, the most generic term that I often use the word secular to be very generic. I don't necessarily mean atheistic, right? But just not religious.
Mm-hmm.
In your life, in your quote unquote secular life now, how do you find community? What do you find meaningful? How do you experience awe?
I find community, wherever you can, really. It's around shared interests. Ironically, a lot of the things that we did in the church. Music, motorcycles, American football in this country, what's what we call it. I played American football for 8 seasons. I coach now for about the last 5 years. I've been a coach.
Oh, cool.
So my fellow coaches, the players, the team, that is I used to say that's my church. Where we live in North Wales here, we're part of a community it's a biker club. So we play music and we have hundreds of people come. We do rallies here where I live with bikers from all over the country. I mean, that's community, but it's around shared interests and passions and, things like that. So that's where I find it.
Excellent.
My students where I teach at the college here in England, I teach carpentry and multi-skills to military veterans and I always end up with some amazing friendships that come out of the classes that I teach. I keep in touch with people, so it's things that I'm passionate about, I guess.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Hmm.
Can you give me the top 3-ish books that have been the most meaningful to you through this process or after this process?
The top one would have to be Robert Lifton's Thought Reform and the Psychology of Totalism, which opened my eyes to the whole cult psychology.
Yeah.
And then I started relating that to evangelicalism. The second one, I think, would be Take Back Your Life by Janja Lalić and Madeline Tobias, okay. which is a very good book about exactly what it says on the tin, you know?
Yeah.
That's the reconstruction piece, which we never actually talked about, but it's where you start to take back everything that was lost, stolen, smashed, destroyed from your old self. Right. And how do you do that? The next book I would have to say now I'm reading was Holy Terror, Conway and Siegelman, which opened me up to studying the religious right, the rise of the religious right in America, which then led me into studying Dominion theology, and which is part of my backstory coming out of Christian education, which is Christian Reconstructionism. So those are three of the top books I would recommend.
Excellent. I do recognize we missed a lot of the Reconstruction stuff. Do you want to talk about that briefly? Like, so sure. What for you was Reconstruction? What would you recommend for people that they're looking for when they are in the process of Reconstruction?
The biggest piece of advice, and I've heard this, I ask the same question every time to someone who's
like
an ex-religious person, and they always say the same thing. They say education is the number one thing. Educate yourself. And that's what I've been doing. That's why those books I recommended were all books that changed my life from a Reconstruction point of view, because they helped me to identify areas in my life where I had been controlled and manipulated and was part of that cult psychology. And I was a pawn in a bigger game in a way, and I wasn't seeing it at the time. But now I can look back and actually identify the various tactics that were used on me and many other people in the system. And I know it's true because I've heard it from many, 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 many people that say, that's what happened to me. You're describing my experience.
Right.
And that helps me to start to disempower what they did to us and say, okay, if I can point my finger to the actual tactic, then I can start to figure out how it affected me psychologically. Then I can start to rebuild. Yeah. And that's the journey I'm really on.
Man, one of the things you just said there really resonates with me as well. One of the purposes of me doing the podcast is for me, that recognition when Clint, you're telling your story and I'm just like, I totally lived that.
Resonate.
Like, and you know, I have guests on that just happens consistently. And then I hear from people who are listeners and they say, that person was telling my story. And they all are unique. Every story is unique, but there's these rhymes that just everyone recognizes as, I went through that phase. That was part of my story.
That's it. And that's why the community is a huge piece. So the education is one, finding a supportive community, wherever that is. What we've been saying is that it's critically important. We need community as humans. And it's important if you're coming out of your faith, your religion, or a cult, to find a group of supportive people that are, they don't have to be from the same story that you had, but we find that typically like ex-Jehovah's Witnesses, ex-Mormons, ex-evangelical, they tend to band together because they all get it.
Yeah.
You know, they came out of the same destructive cult or whatever. And so, they resonate and they can offer the support that only a person coming out of that particular context can give. And so that's what's really important, is to find that community.
Absolutely. I wanted to give you just a minute to plug the work that you're doing. I understand you've been doing a lot of blog posts on Medium, one of which we discussed on Seekers and Skeptics a bit about the number of different ways that people go through deconstruction. Tell us about the work that you're doing these days.
That's true. I've been doing a lot of work, as I was saying, on cult psychology, as well as Christian Reconstructionism, Dominion theology, the religious right. So I tend to seek out people on the show that are experts in the field or authors. I've just got an episode coming out with Catherine Stewart, who wrote the book, The Power Worshippers. It just came out in March. And she talks about the rise of Christian nationalism in America and the world, really. And I'm chasing down other people to have on the show that are experts in Christian Reconstructionism, Dominion theology, because I find a lot of people don't know much about that.
Right.
And they're very underinformed as to what's actually going on. Again, not just in America, that's the most clear example, but we're seeing it in Brazil and in other places where there's alliances with evangelicalism from a political point of view, and their agenda is really quite chilling. They want to establish a theocracy, and it's going to become like a Handmaid's Tale type thing. And that's really not, it's not an overstatement, actually.
Yeah.
Quite scary.
You know, and I live in the state, so I see Betsy DeVos, and
yeah,
and like everything is moving that direction. And what's fascinating to me is it's absolutely special pleading. Christianity gets all these perks, and but if you were to say, well, a mosque should also get money, you're rebuilding or something, it's like, no way, that's not going to happen. Yeah. So we've completely abandoned separation of church and state.
Exactly. We have Bible studies led by Ralph Drollinger in the White House, in Congress weekly. The Congress, they're fine with that. Mike Pence drops in, absolutely fine. Trump has an evangelical advisory board. And someone said, well, why doesn't he have a Muslim advisory board?
Right.
Why doesn't he have a Scientology advisory board?
Yeah.
They should be, in accordance with the terms of religious freedom and religious tolerance in America, every religion should be equally represented.
Yeah.
So why is it only these particular evangelical dominionists that get to get these Bible studies and all these influences in the Trump administration? So that is affecting legislation right now today. They have a vision and they are working to make it happen.
Yeah. And your Mindshift podcast, I know that there's a few podcasts out there that have that name. How do they find your podcast if they're looking for it?
That's true. Because it's funny, I my wife actually suggests the name and I kind of didn't realize at the time there's about three or four other shows with the same name. I changed the name. I did all the work. And then I went on there to iTunes. I thought, oh my God, there's like four Mindshift podcasts. Yeah. What have I done?
Yeah.
Then for a minute there, I thought I might be in trouble. This like copyright issues or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Nobody said anything. So I'm kind of playing it safe. But
yeah,
if you look for my name, basically, I'm the only one that has Dr. Clint Haycock on it. You'll find me there. That's me. The other ones tend to be like education podcasts. And there's one from a church. So I thought that was kind of interesting. Maybe they'll end up listening to a sermon and think that it's me. You know? So, don't get the wrong Mindshift podcast.
That's right.
You could think, what's this guy? He's preaching a sermon all of a sudden.
Well, I just wanted to thank you for being on the podcast. And we talked briefly about still having kind of a pastor's heart and really still acting that out. I hear that in you. I hear that in your work. It's very clear that you care about people.
Yeah.
That's what this podcast is all about, is how do we care about people more? I think the work that you're doing, helping people to recognize the cultic nature of their previous faith, is really, really important. Thank you so much for being on the show and sharing all that wisdom with us.
Yeah. Thank you so much, David, for being a great host. I want to have you as a guest on Mindshift podcast. So we need to talk about how we can make that happen too.
That sounds great. Final thoughts on the episode. There was so much resonance between Clint and I. I think we have very similar experiences and very similar perspectives on the post-religious life and how we connect with one another, how we maintain the human needs in community. It was just a great conversation to have with him. I thought the conversation about the potential difference between deconstruction and deconversion was really interesting. I know I sometimes come across as the stronger atheist. And it's important for me to remember that deconstruction is definitely a part of that process. I'm very much interested in meeting people where they are at and not necessarily having them conform to what I think they should be thinking. So wherever you are in your deconstruction or reconstruction, I hope you'll listen to the podcast and enjoy it. I'm also fascinated by the work that Clint is doing and specifically the people that he has interviewed in the expertise of cults. The overlap of evangelicalism and cultic-like practices is fascinating. And as Clint himself said, it's not to say that all of evangelicalism is a cult, but there are practices which can be more or less cultic and manipulative. Recognizing those manipulations is important. I highly recommend that you check out the Mindshift podcast and in particular some of those episodes that focus on the ways in which cults manipulate people and see if you recognize some of those things from your faith tradition. Clint really touched on something when you remove yourself from the context, he said, psychologically and physically, that's when you're able to get some space to start critically thinking. And that critical thinking may lead to deconstruction. And finally, I think his best advice was get yourself educated. Knowledge is really the key. When we are in the bubble, and depending on how high demand the religious tradition you were a part of, there may be many resources or sources of information that were not allowed, that were verboten. And now there are no restrictions. I highly recommend that you read everything. Read the Bible, read apologists, read atheists, read everyone, and come to your own conclusions. The entire point is that now you are free to seek information and interpret it in light of reality rather than in light of a body of dogmatic tradition. I want to thank Clint for being on the podcast and for sharing his heart for people. Again, I resonated so much with him of being kind of a former ex-pastor or ex-teacher, at least, of wanting so badly to convey the right things, and then ultimately that being a part of what led to our own deconstructions, and in my case, full-blown deconversion. Thank you, Clint, for the work that you do, and I hope that everyone will go out and listen to the Mindshift podcast. I will have links in the show notes for that. I hope you will stay tuned. I have a number of exciting episodes coming up. I've already done the interviews. I'm really excited about them. One is Amy Logan of the Ex-Mormonology podcast. Another is Richard Swan, who is the director of the London City Voices. If you haven't heard of them, you got to check this out on YouTube. It is amazing, the community that he has built. They sing pop songs in a choir. And then they go out to the pub afterwards and hang out with each other. It's amazing the community that he's building there. Stay tuned for those episodes coming up shortly. And as Clint hinted at the end of the episode, I will be joining him on his podcast. We've already done that interview, and that will be released in the next few weeks. Until then, as always, my name is David, and I am trying to be the graceful atheist. Join me in being graceful human beings. Time for some footnotes. The song is a track called Waves by Micaiah Beats. Please check out her music. Links will be in the show notes. If you'd like to help support the podcast, here are the ways you can go about that. First, help promote it. The podcast audience grows by word of mouth. If you found it useful or just entertaining, please pass it on to your friends and family. Post about it on social media so that others can find it. Please rate and review the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. This will help raise the visibility of our show. Join me on the podcast. Tell your story. Have you gone through a faith transition? You want to tell that to the world? Let me know and let's have you on. Do you know someone who needs to tell their story? Let them know. Do you have criticisms about atheism or humanism, but you're willing to have an honesty contest with me? Come on the show. If you have a book or a blog that you want to promote, I'd like to hear from you. Also, you can contribute technical support. If you are good at graphic design, sound engineering, or marketing, please let me know and I'll let you know how you can participate. And finally, financial support. There will be a link on the show notes to allow contributions which would help defray the cost of producing the show. If you want to get in touch with me, you can Google Graceful Atheist, or you can send email to gracefulatheist@gmail.com. You can tweet at me at gracefulatheist. Or you can just check out my website at gracefulatheist.wordpress.com. Get in touch and let me know if you appreciate the podcast. Well, this has been the Graceful Atheist Podcast. My name is David, and I am trying to be the graceful atheist. Grab somebody you love and tell them how much they mean to you. This has been Graceful Atheist Podcast.